WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Cold War, tens of thousands of American men traveled underwater in cramped submarines on spy missions off the coasts of the Soviet Union. The submarines were hidden deep in the ocean, and their missions were kept under wraps through top-secret classification. The sub's most important weapons included cameras, advanced sonar, and complicated eavesdropping equipment. The story of Cold War submarine espionage is told in the new bestseller Blind Man's Bluff. My guests are the authors, journalists Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew. Drew is special projects editor at the New York Times. Sontag has worked at the Times and written for the National Law Journal. I asked them if the American public was told anything about these Cold War submarines.
No, the public was really told nothing. Before we started working on the book, we kind of figured what I think most people do, that we had missile submarines that were hiding in the ocean with ballistic missiles ready to fire if a war broke out. And we had other kind of submarines, attack submarines, that, as far as anybody knew, were just sort of out in the Atlantic practicing for a replay of World War II. I don't think most people had any idea that submarines had become one of the most important spy vehicles of the Cold War.
Even more astounding is that not only did the general public know, but these men went out and they didn't tell their families, their wives, their kids, their best friends. Sometimes the folks who were spooks, the spies on board, did not tell anybody else on board what they were doing. So this information was very tightly held. In fact, it was so tightly held it was given classifications higher than top secret.
Some of the subs had self-destruct mechanisms so that if they were captured, the captain could blow up the American submarine and the secrets that the American sub carried would never be revealed to the Soviets. Why was that considered necessary, and did any captain actually resort to blowing up their sub and their men?
I never quite got that far, but one of the most chilling things in a lot of the interviews we did in talking to the men who served on the four special submarines over the years that did the cable tapping, was to hear them describe practicing self-destruct drills on their way over to the Soviet waters. They would actually go right into a Soviet sea, comparable to a Soviet sub coming into the Chesapeake Bay, and let out divers. And these divers would actually leave the submarine, hook up this huge tap pod with recorders to these undersea communications cables, and they'd be working about 300 or 400 feet deep. And Soviet ships in one location, Soviet ships were constantly passing overhead. It was such a dangerous area to be in. And these men were taking all this risk, really putting their lives on the line, but this was one of the most productive kinds of intelligence operations we ran during the whole Cold War.
What were the results of being able to tap this cable? What did Americans learn about the Soviets?
Well, what we really learned, it was really an inside look at the Soviets' game plan for what they were going to do with their Navy and their missile subs in a time of war. If you can imagine that this was a form of communications for the Soviets that they felt was impenetrable, I mean, you know, if you bounce communications off a satellite, somebody could intercept them on the way back down. These words that were flowing through these undersea cables were often not encrypted at all, or only lightly encrypted, because the Soviets just never dreamed we'd be able to sneak into their sea and snatch these communications. And so they sent their most sensitive messages, where their nuclear missile subs were going to hide in the time of war, what kind of condition they were in, where they would go on patrols, just everything you'd really want to know if your main aim was to try to counter their missile subs.
How did the Soviets find out that we were tapping their underwater cables?
A spy named Ronald Pelton, who worked for our National Security Agency, tipped them off in 1980 to the first location where we were doing it. Pelton was a guy who had gotten in financial trouble, filed bankruptcy, ended up selling this secret for $35,000 This was one of the most sensitive and important things we did in intelligence in the whole Cold War. What was fascinating is that even though some people within our intelligence agencies were warning, I mean, we didn't know exactly how the Soviets had found the cable at first. It took about 5 years before we caught up with Pelton. And even though it was still a mystery, we kept sending some of these submarines to these other location on the other side of the world, up in the Barents Sea, up over Europe, to tap cables there, because this was so productive that nobody wanted to stop doing it, even though we realized there was could be a big risk that there could be a spy.
Were any of the American subs that were tapping Soviet communications discovered by the Soviets?
They were detected on occasion, but not really. It's like the Soviets heard something, and with the USS Parchee, another submarine that was nearby sent as a decoy, made a lot of noise and just lured the Soviets away. So they were detected but not captured, and nobody understood what they were there for and what they were doing.
We tell the story in the book, a very dramatic moment in 1986, when President Reagan was meeting Gorbachev in Reykjavik at the summit there. And that was one summit that came up very quickly. And the USS Parchee, one of the best of these cable-tapping submarines, was out on its way to a cable-tapping site near Murmansk, the huge Soviet port up around the Arctic Circle. And she was actually stopped by radio message and told not to go into Soviet waters while Reagan was in Iceland. The last thing we wanted to do was take a chance of her getting caught and something messing up that summit meeting. And the minute Reagan's plane, the wheels were up on his plane to leave Iceland, the order went to Parchee to go in. And that was one case. After she had done her work and she was starting to leave, the people on board described this ping off the side of the submarine. And some Soviet ship had found her there. And this was one case where another decoy submarine rushed in and created a lot of noise, and the Soviets chased her, and the Parchee got away.
What do you think might have happened if one of the communications espionage submarines were actually captured by the Soviets? Do you think, like, a war would have broken out after that?
You know, the men were told that they would never be captured. That's what the self-destruct charges were all about. And we used to wonder as we were writing whether or not this could have started World War III, this could have derailed the Entente, it could have done a lot of things, but the bottom line is it never did. And it's very strange because there was a collision between two of our subs, the Tautog and a Soviet sub, where each side left thinking that they had sunk the other. Ultimately, the Soviets realized the U.S. sub was still up, but we never did realize that the Soviet sub was up. And that didn't start a war, even though the collision was terrible and people almost died. And it seemed that because so much of this was so hidden, and if there was an incident, it was easy to keep a secret and it wasn't something that was made public, that both sides held back in ways that they didn't always in other arenas in the spy program. So I think in the end we came to the conclusion that it would have been highly unlikely that war would have broken out over this.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the two authors of a new book called Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage. My guests are journalist Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are journalist Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew, authors of the new book Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage, and it's about submarine espionage during the Cold War. You know, you have these instances of American subs chasing, tracking Soviet subs that had nuclear missiles on them. I'm wondering if there were ever any near collisions of subs that had nuclear missiles on them or ever any near catastrophes with nuclear missiles that you found out about in the research for your book.
Well, Terry, there were a couple things that happened. In the days when the Soviets were first sending their missile subs to sea in the 1960s, and it became a big priority to trail them and see where they were going so we could take them out if a war happened, one of the first missions like that was a huge success. One of our submarines followed a Soviet missile sub for 47 days all through the Atlantic and learned exactly where it was going to hide and taped its sounds by hanging very close to it. I mean, if you can picture two cars going down the interstate, one right behind the other, for a long time, and you're in the rear car and you can't see the other guy in front of you. You're just listening to these sonar sounds to try to interpret how he's moving. And really, that's sort of where the name Blind Man's Bluff comes from for the book. It was highly dangerous. So the first time it was done in a big way, it was a huge success. So every other sub-captain who came out there wanted to do the same thing and get a medal from the president, which that first boat had gotten. And what do you know, the very next year, there's three collisions between American and Soviet subs. And over the years, there were 12 to 15 collisions. And it would happen in just that way, that they would be very close to each other. They would be trying to learn everything they could about each other. One would turn one way. Somebody would misinterpret it as they're listening on the sonar headset or watching on a computer screen that gave a sense of what the sounds were indicating. And now when you go back and talk to both sides, because we had a researcher in Russia do a lot, of course, whose fault a given collision was depends on which side you're asking. But it was that kind of blind world, and it was very dangerous, and there were a lot of times where these subs just smashed right into each other.
Were there ever any lost nuclear weapons in the sea?
Most of these submarines that had collisions were carrying some type of nuclear weapons, either nuclear missiles or nuclear-tipped torpedoes. The one case where one of the Soviet missile subs sank in the late 1960s, a Gulf submarine that had three ballistic missiles that had been targeted against the United States, was one of the big episodes of this whole submarine battle, because we were able to detect where the submarine was lost, and it was very clear that the Soviets had no idea where they had lost their submarine. And this gave rise to one of the biggest missions of the whole Cold War, the effort to raise the Soviet sub, because we wanted to try to recover these missiles and some of the encoded transmitters for communications. And one of the fascinating things that we have in the book is that the Soviet sub was located by one of our special project submarines, the Halibut, and it dangled cameras 20,000 feet deep in the Pacific Ocean, basically just dangled them on elevator cable with laser lights, and took 22,000 photographs of this sunken submarine on the bottom of the ocean. A few of the photographs had pictures of the skeleton of one of the Soviet sailors lying on the seabed nearby, and it was just his stark white bones, still wearing his foul weather jacket and his boots. And these pictures were shown to President Nixon, and that's what gave rise to an effort that has been reported in the past, where the CIA enlisted Howard Hughes, the eccentric billionaire, as a cover story to build a huge ship that was going to try to recover this Soviet submarine.
It was also a very famous failure, because the Navy right all along wanted to just try to recover maybe the code books, maybe a missile warhead by sending down a small submersible. The CIA, in a massive move of one-upmanship, made this effort to build this enormous crane-laden ship called the Glomar Explorer, reach down and grab the entire sub, and of course it fell apart en route, and everything that the Navy thought would be of value was lost.
Now, the men who worked on these submarines were sworn to secrecy. This was top secret stuff. How did you get them to talk with you? Because they're still sworn to secrecy. There's no statute of limitations that has expired on that.
No, actually, as they would go out on these missions, each time they'd go out, they'd have to sign security oaths that basically, where they promised not to talk for 25, 30 years about anything they had done. And it was very hard going for us. We started in the early 1990s, and the Cold War was still very fresh. And it was hard to get people to talk. We traveled all over the country. We interviewed hundreds of people. A lot of people wouldn't talk. Sometimes the Naval Investigative Service, when they heard we were in an area talking to people, would call people, particularly ones who had been on these cable tapping boats, and tell them not to talk, remind them of their oaths. But over time, not only the men on the boats, but also lots of high-level intelligence officials and White House officials from different time frames, just came to feel that it's about time the public knew what went on. It's about time that some of these men got credit for the risks they took. And it's really, even they recognize that, you know, in the middle of a crisis situation, a period like the Cold War, where there's a huge foe and things need to be secret, that there comes a time like now when you've got to be able to pull up and the public's got to be able to evaluate what went on, because we know another secretive period's going to come later. And so there were enough people at high level as well as low who came to feel that, that we were able to dig out the story.
Our submarine program was a very expensive program, and the people who worked on those subs were very brave. Was it a very productive program? Did we get a lot out of it finally?
Well, we went into this book, into the research on it, feeling very skeptical about that question. We were concerned. I mean, so little had come out, and we'd heard about some of these collisions and these subs hanging off the Soviet coast, and we went in really thinking we were going to find a bunch of stories about a bunch of cowboys just playing games and acting like fighter jocks and having a good time. In the end, we were persuaded. I mean, you can never really know because we don't have access to all the information that was gathered. But in the end, after meeting so many of these men, and when you stop and realize that once the Soviets did have submarines that were hiding in the ocean with missiles on them and pointed at New York, Washington, and all our other cities, we had to have some means of tracking them, some means of learning what they could do, where they were going, and this was really the only way to do it. And so, in that sense, we came to feel that, in the end, it was a worthwhile program.
We also came to feel that they did a really good job.
Now that the Cold War is over, what is our submarine fleet being used for?
Well, we're still using the submarines for general surveillance, just like we did during the Cold War. It's just that the setting has changed. We'll occasionally still send submarines off of Russia to keep an eye on what the remaining submarines that they have are doing, which these days is mostly just sitting in port or sitting close to home. But you'll mainly find submarines now every time there's a crisis in Iraq or some Middle Eastern hotspot. Submarines are there off the coast gathering intelligence, usually being kind of a scouting party before the aircraft carriers and the other ships and planes go in.
Do the Russians still have a lot of submarines?
They still have a lot of them, although they don't have the money to operate them. One of the cruel ironies for the Soviets was that they finally, in the late 80s, were learning how to make good, quiet submarines that rivaled ours in quality, but that's about when they ran out of money. And so they only made a few that were pretty good. Basically, you know, the bigger threat right now from Russia is not what Russia does with its own subs, but Russia has been selling a lot of high-quality, sophisticated diesel submarines that are very quiet in their operations to countries like Iran and China. And that's a more potent threat in certain ways right now. It's not that there's that many of them. It's not that the Iranians particularly are known for their seamanship. But, for instance, the Iranian admirals have said, we could take three of these Russian diesel submarines and we could use them to blockade the Strait of Hormuz and block the West oil supply if we really get provoked. And in truth, they could probably do a decent job of that for some period of time before we would be able to get in and take them out. So there's not the grand, you know, huge navies facing off the way there was in the Cold War anymore. The foes out there now are fairly ragtag, but in limited areas like that, there could be a threat from other submarines.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Christopher Drew and Sherry Sontag are the authors of the bestseller Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.